Hello and welcome to the new series of Parkinson's Life, the award-winning podcast offering a voice to the global Parkinson's community. Each episode, we bring together people impacted by the condition for an honest conversation to share their stories, perspectives, and ideas on how to live well with Parkinson's. In this episode, we're looking at the relationship between Parkinson's and loneliness. There are many reasons that people with Parkinson's might experience feelings of loneliness. These might include isolation because of communication challenges, stigma surrounding symptoms, and difficulties explaining the realities of the condition to anyone who hasn't experienced it themselves. A lot of this has been exacerbated by the coronavirus pandemic, as social distancing, self-isolation, and lockdowns have made it harder to connect. Our first guest is Vit Sarushan, who was diagnosed with Parkinson's in 2008. Before moving to Spain, Vitsa had a fast-paced career as a lobbyist in Belgium, but says that his pace of life has slowed down since diagnosis. He's experienced mental health symptoms associated with Parkinson's, and says that it's been difficult to communicate some of the challenges linked to the condition, even to close friends and family. He is joined by Indu Subramanian, a movement disorder neurologist based in Los Angeles, US. Indu recently worked on a study which suggested that people with Parkinson's who experience loneliness may have more severe symptoms and a worse quality of life. She also brings her interest in yoga, mindfulness, and other alternative treatments to the discussion. In this episode, Vitsa and Indu discuss why connecting with others is so important, how to find ways of coping with loneliness, and why it's vital to learn to appreciate the little things.
So my name is Vitsa Sarushan. I'm living in Spain now. I was born in the Netherlands. I'm 50 years old, and I was diagnosed with Parkinson's in 2008, so almost 13 years ago now.
And my name is Indu Subramanian. I'm a neurologist here at UCLA. I run our Center of Excellence at the West Los Angeles VA, which is the Veterans Administration. I have been in practice for about 20 years, and I'm based in Los Angeles, California. But I'm originally Indian and went to medical school in Canada, which is where I grew up. So, Vitsa, you were diagnosed in 2008. Could you tell us a little bit about how you got to be diagnosed, what your symptoms were at the time, and maybe tell us a little bit about the course of your Parkinson's, bringing us up to 2021?
Yes, I was diagnosed in 2008, and the indications or the symptoms I had at that time was that everybody was trying to pull my jacket. So if I was wearing a suit, people tried to straighten my jacket because they thought my suit was not straight. But in fact, it was me who wasn't straight. So one of my shoulders was higher than the other one. And at a certain moment in the morning, I was going to go to the bakery shop to buy some croissant for my breakfast. Somebody in the street was yelling at me, "Alcoholic, drunken man." And I said, "What is going on?" It was 9 o'clock in the morning. I was just having my coffee. And he thought I was drunk because of the way I was walking. And that made me think of having a problem and having to go to the doctor to check this. And indeed, after a first opinion that I had with a doctor who did not recognize Parkinson, but thought it was stress and prescribed me 9 sessions of massage, I went to a second hospital where the doctor was more going into details and checking me out completely. And then it turned out to be Parkinson. I was able, luckily, to work for 6 more years without too many problems. But in 2014, Parkinson was so invasive, the way I was walking, the way I was talking, rigid. I had the Parkinson mask, as you call that, so my face was completely stiff. I had to stop working in 2014. Then, after a third opinion, if you want, I changed my doctor from Belgium to the Netherlands. I had a complete change of medication. I was able to work again for 2 more years in 2016, 2017. And then I really had to stop working. And I moved to Spain. And I must say that if I look at myself now, my Parkinson condition today, I feel much better than I was feeling in 2014, 2015. I know it's a progressive disease, but in my case, the fact that I took out the stress, that I am living a more quiet life, is doing me very well. So I feel much more better than 5, 6, 7 years ago.
So you mentioned your gait and balance and the motor symptoms, but maybe tell us a little bit about your non-motor symptoms.
I was looking the other day, also in preparation of this podcast, I was looking into the exact date I was diagnosed, and it was 24 July 2008. But then I was also looking at my medical history around that time, and I was already having depressions and anxieties, fears before the diagnosis. And I never saw that or considered that as part of Parkinson, possibly, which I only realize now that it could be already indications of having Parkinson. I thought it was mostly related to stress. I was working very hard at the time. I had a burnout just before I was diagnosed. But for me, that has nothing to do with Parkinson. But now I understand that it could have been already a kind of, indication that I was having Parkinson. It would be possible that it's part of the disease. Over the time, I don't know if that is the Parkinson disease or if it is the medication, but I had quite some problems with impulsive disorders. I always thought that this linked to some of the medication I was taking, for example, shopping, online shopping, gambling. That became a very big problem during the course of the last decade. And of course, that also has to do with shame. It's very hard to talk about addictions or behavioral problems you have due to medication. So Parkinson is already quite a burden, but to have these side effects is made it even more difficult.
As I was going through my neurology training, I was always drawn to Parkinson's patients because I could get to know them over time. It was a very complex sort of problem. Not everyone was exactly the same. You know, we have young patients, young women, we have older men, you know, different sorts of cultures that can really manifest Parkinson's in very different ways, depending on your social support network and who you are and what you bring to the sort of disease history from your life before you got Parkinson's. It's all very fascinating to me. So I've always been interested in this area. I have been a Western trained doctor. So I went to medical school in Toronto and, have learned a lot about medications and deep brain surgeries and all these sorts of really, new technologies around treating this complex disease. But I've also been in my own personal life exploring the effects of things like yoga and meditation on my body and learning about these areas. So at some point, about 5 or 6 years ago, I ended up doing a bit of a deeper dive. I got a yoga teacher training and learned a lot of mindfulness training and how to teach both of these to people as they age and to our Parkinson's patients. And I was really fascinated by the effects of these sorts of mind-body practices, along with a host of other things that patients can possibly control somewhat of their day-to-day lifestyles and help themselves to feel better.
If I may just go back to when I was having my, let's say, depressions and anxieties of around 2008, before I was diagnosed, I met a lady in Belgium who was specialized in meditation and relaxation. And really, she saved my life by teaching me exercises, how to regulate my breathing, how to become calm. And that really helped me much more than any pills could have ever done to me. Also, if I may say, in 2015, I was still being treated in Belgium, and it was more, let's say, the classical approach like you described before, increase of medication, and you come back in 6 months. Between the sessions with my doctor, during those 6 months, there was no follow-up, there were no other initiatives made. But then in 2015, after an interview I did with a Dutch newspaper, about Parkinson and me having to stop working, I got contacted by a lady unknown to me, and she said, I'm in the board of the Radboud Hospital in Nijmegen in the Netherlands, and I would like to invite you for a treatment here because we have a very good department led by Professor Bas Bloem. And I went there on a Monday morning, and that really changed my life because for the first time, somebody was able to explain me what is Parkinson's. Besides, he changed my medication into levodopa. And thirdly, they invited me to what is called a Parkinson Day. And that means that in one day, you are meeting psychologists, physiotherapists, neurologists, all kinds of doctors who are dealing with Parkinson from a different angle, but they all work together. As you know, it's a holistic disease with many complexities. It's not only neurological, it's much more than that. And there in one day, I could visit all those doctors, and I was really pleasantly surprised with that holistic approach that I got there. And it really changed a lot for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, there's a lot to be done in education about, first of all, who can get the disease. I think, you know, a lot of people miss the diagnosis at first. And a lot of, you know, certain people, like if you look like me and you get symptoms, people will think you're crazy for the first 5 years of your diagnosis sometimes, you know. So I think we really have to dispel the myth of it's just affecting older, you know, Caucasian men or something like that. But then, you know, we talk about the symptoms and how they present and actually what really affects quality of life. I think so much of what we've talked about is a movement disorder, right? Because that's what we're classified as. I'm a movement disorder specialist, and it's a motor disease. And we talk about tremor or stiffness. But when we really sit down and start talking to our patients about what troubles them every day and the types of things that they're really facing, it's really these sort of non-motor issues. And I think people really want to be able to do something in those 6 months for themselves. So if we can teach them, you know, a schedule of things, and you met a physiotherapist, how important exercise is literally from day one of diagnosis, and even how important, you know, things like social connection or other, you know, how important sleep is. If you get a good night's sleep, you feel so much better. I think these things are not well talked about. So I think patients are hungry for this type of information. And so that's sort of been my passion, is to kind of help them understand what they can do for themselves. And I think in driving that bus, they can feel better. Maybe you could tell me a little bit about your sense of how important it is for connection, social connection, and engaging with the community around you, and how that's affected you throughout, you know, your course of symptoms as well as in the pandemic.
Yes, at the beginning, when I had to stop working, of course, the first thing that you lose is your professional networks, the people that you know due to your work, and of course that stops at a certain moment. It's also a very good way to discover who are your real friends and who are only friends because of your job or your position. But of course, you have to discover a complete new network. So you have to change the professional network for other people. And I found, and I still find, it is still difficult to explain what I'm going through on a daily basis to people who do not have Parkinson's. So it is obvious that it's easier to exchange with people who have Parkinson's. So I have, of course, friends mainly in the Netherlands and Belgium, not so much here in Spain, who have Parkinson's, and we talk almost daily by chat and by FaceTime about our experiences every day. But this being unable to explain to people, even if they're very close to you, even to family members in the Netherlands or friends who you think you know very well, it's still very hard to explain, for example, mood swings or the things you're going through because you have a bad day. And even that you can have a bad moment in a good day or good moments in a bad day, that's very hard to explain to, let's say, non-Parkinson people. But having a dog has been a great support for me, because it's not only companionship, it's also structure. And I think structure is essential for me. We have to live by the clock almost, because we have to take our pills at a certain time. So it's very important to get you through the day, that you have fixed moments in the day. In my case, it's walking the dog, of course, but also seeing the physiotherapist twice a week, having the chats with my friends. Normally, we do that every morning. And to socially engage, I'm now living in Spain. I have promised myself that at least one meal every day I have to take outside. During the pandemic, that was, of course, very difficult. It was impossible. So that was very hard, I must say, but we will probably come back to the pandemic. But now at least one meal I try to take outside, because it also forces you to talk to people and to meet new people. And I just met a yoga teacher here on the beach by accident. And normally he will start doing yoga sessions with me as of tomorrow. So I'm very happy with that. And the dog really saved my life, because when we were not supposed to be outside, I was still allowed to walk my dog every day. So that keeps me going, literally. And of course, it also gives you some purpose to live for. And in my case, I like to write. And also writing, I try to write every day. It also gives you structure, and it also gives me some purpose.
That's great. I think the structure is really important. So we really have been trying to emphasize, you know, trying to wake up at the same time, trying to go to sleep at the same time, and building certain activities throughout the day that you look forward to, certain things around exercise, and even trying to build in the social engagement, which I really think is commendable that you've been going out for meals. And, you know, even if it's small snippets of, you know, socialization, if it's talking to the coffee person at Starbucks or wherever you get a coffee, or the mailman or your neighbor, or, you know, you can kind of, you know, say hello to somebody in the grocery store. I think it can make, you know, a huge difference. The pets, of course, you have to take care of. And, you know, I think that's an amazing thing. And we also realize that, you know, it's sometimes the connection of touch, sometimes the connection of somebody being physically with you that is very soothing and grounding. So I think that it's not just, you know, purpose around caring for somebody, having to feed them and take them out, but also perhaps having, you know, this companionship, which is really helpful. The writing, I think, is amazing. I think anytime you can engage sort of the mental state, a creative side, sometimes people can find it meditative even to journal. So I'd be kind of intrigued as to what you write about every day.
When I was working, I was a lobbyist in Brussels. Now I was talking to presidents, commissioners, CEOs, and now I'm talking to my dog, let's say. I think I had 300 emails coming in my inbox every day when I was working. Now I get 6 emails. So life is completely different. I'm not talking to presidents now, I'm talking to dogs. And that's a process of acceptation that I had to go through, to accept that I'm now, let's say, I moved from the highway to the byway, and to appreciate the byway, because when you are in the rat race and you're only going very fast on the highway, you only look in front of you, but you don't see what's around you. And I learned by force, by Parkinson's, to be on the byway, but to enjoy the views and to see the mountains and to see the nature. Appreciation of that, which before I was not even thinking about. I just wanted to be successful and make money. So I think that is, you could call that a hidden gift of Parkinson's, that I was forced, but happily so, to appreciate walking with my dog, seeing the nature, walking in the mountains, walking at the beach every day, which is something completely new in my life. So also my writing is about simple things. It's about daily life things, things that happen to you when you walk with your dog. Also things that, let's say, funny things that happen to you when you have Parkinson's. Sometimes when you are walking your dog and he's doing his toilet, let's say, I have to clean, of course. And you can imagine sometimes with Parkinson, it's very hard for me to make all the movements and to follow my dog. And sometimes, as people say, I'm not walking the dog, but the dog is walking me. And often that's true. When I'm having a bad day, my dog pulls me and I just have to follow. But sometimes I think he can feel that. He can feel that I'm having a bad day. Dogs are amazing in that. He can feel that I'm having a bad day, that I don't want to walk, that I feel miserable. And then he takes the first step and says, come on, Wietse, we have to go out. It's good for you and it's good for me. And he pulls me almost out. And then, well, I will follow and I become happy, because I cannot be unhappy with looking in his big brown eyes. It's very hard.
You mentioned sometimes, you know, that it's hard to get motivated. Have you had apathy as well as part of?
Yes, yes. I had a very bad period, especially when I was having dystonia. For almost 1 year, I had very strong pain in my right foot, dystonia, and it took on sometimes 10 hours a day of pain. And then I have to admit, I was really feeling depressed. I was even willing to give up, because 10 hours of pain, I think nobody can handle that. And then it's, of course, due to motor issues, I was not able to walk a lot. I was not even able to walk my dog at that time. And then you get very depressed, because it's very important, as you said yourself, to go out there and to meet people and still to be active. Also, thanks to the pandemic, you appreciate more people who are close to you, neighbors who I never talked to before, become very good friends, because, well, they see that you need help. To give you one very silly story, my dog needed drops in his ears every day because he had an ear infection. So I had to put his drops. But for me, with Parkinson's, very difficult to do that on my own. So I needed one person to hold my dog and one person to put the drops. And my neighbor, who I, before the pandemic, never talked to really, he was every night at 7:30, he came to my house. He put the eardrops in the ear of my dog, and we had a little glass of wine to talk about the day. And that also is, a structure, help on, let's say, short distance, unexpected help. And it also gives you new social contact. So thanks to the pandemic or the ear infection of my dogs, I actually made new friends very close.
That's a beautiful story. I think, I think we've all had that sort of experience. I think we realize how connected we all are globally with the pandemic, with the virus spreading and, you know, affecting different communities around us, and also how important, you know, our own neighborhoods are. And so a lot of what I've been talking about is just, you know, smiling at your neighbors and making sure that people are okay and feeling kind of connected, even if you feel disconnected, you know, or socially distanced or whatever, physically distanced or whatever we've been using these words. I think ultimately the social connection is just so key. And I think seeking that out and being open to the possibilities of even asking for help sometimes, I think, can be very hard for people, or accepting help if somebody wants to give you help. At the Veterans Administration, where I work, we've been talking a lot about this and finding ways to sort of socially connect and support our patients with this social prescription kind of concept. And so the concept is that we literally, as doctors, you know, proactively ask people about how they're doing and how their social support mechanisms are and if they're lonely. And then we can literally write a prescription or consult to a service at our VA. So a lot of volunteers used to physically come in before the pandemic to volunteer and hand out, you know, drinks or books to the patients up in the wards and stuff like that, or refreshments to the people waiting in the lobby. So, you know, these people really had volunteerism that was part of their identity every day that, or every week that they would come in. And so when we had them stop coming because of the restrictions, we wanted to engage them in a different way. And so they had this concept of having phone calls that were proactive, that were made to folks that were lonely, and also possibly, you know, using a tablet or Zoom or other technology to connect them in a video visit of some sort. And so this is something that we've been rolling out throughout the country, modeling some of these strategies that are being used in the United Kingdom and other parts of the world. But I think it's sort of a really unique way to look at healthcare and provision and what defines health and the things that we can do for people in a more holistic way. And so it's not just me, as you mentioned, sitting in a white coat, giving you a prescription every 6 months and with a 15-minute visit, and there's nothing going on in between. It's really sort of thinking about that multidisciplinary team approach. So you mentioned, you know, the physical therapists and the psychologists maybe, or different folks, but even expanding that more into who in the community can really support our patients living with Parkinson's.
As you mentioned, Indu, it's very important that you are open to ask help, in my case. Eh? So first of all, sometimes people are ashamed to ask help or to reach out, because first of all, if you say, I have Parkinson's, not everybody wants to talk about that. But my experience is that if you mention that you have Parkinson's, some people react completely like, oh my God, it's a bit like a taboo still for many people. But once you are open about it, people are much more reacting positively than you expect, as I gave the example. But of course, it takes you to open up and to say, I have Parkinson's and I need help. But that's not easy, I must say. But once you do it, it's almost always positively received.
Yeah, absolutely. I think getting out of your comfort zone a little bit is something that one has to do. And I think as we emerge, hopefully, from this pandemic, I think, you know, there's baby steps that need to happen. I know some of our patients have been really overwhelmed with the concept of just reintegrating and going back to, you know, a society that will probably never be the same, right? So a lot of folks have lost loved ones. There's been a huge number of changes, transitions. And I think that you know, the concepts of running around without really having, you know, the rat race that you mentioned that you used to be in, I think has been realigned for many of us to understand the sort of importance of just, you know, slowing down a little bit and appreciating all the things that are around us and the people that are around us, and really what makes life rich and what is meaningful to us.
You're listening to the Parkinson's Life podcast with Witzer and Indu. Be sure to subscribe on your podcast platform to hear more from the series.
Just to sort of touch on loneliness and social isolation a little bit more, it wasn't something that I had learned about in medical school, to be honest. We learn about a lot of things in those 4 years, but, you know, many of the determinants of health that I think are actually so key were not emphasized. And so it is something that we as physicians and providers are not necessarily going to be proactive. And I think when people feel lonely or alone, it's sometimes accompanied by a sense of shame, because I think sometimes those feelings when we were in high school, may have been accompanied by, I'm not likable, or nobody wants to sit with me at the lunchroom table, things like that. And so that feeling, which is really this sort of gap between the relationships that we desire and the relationships that we have, it's sort of this subjective feeling, can sometimes be kind of embarrassing or have stigma. But I think, it's very common. I think a lot of people have expressed this problem, and it really can affect our health. And so as providers, we need to be a little bit more proactive about asking about this.
When you were talking about relationships, I was just going to say, if you have a partner on the moment you get diagnosed, I think it is different than if you have no partner. For me, it's very difficult to find a new partner, let's say, with Parkinson's, because you have to explain that you have to take all those pills every day, that it takes you 1 hour to get out of your bed in the morning. And it's not very romantic, let's say, on a first day to say, sorry, I can't stand up from my bed because I'm waiting for my dopamine to kick in. And it's not very romantic to say, sorry, I have to do a little nap now because I'm very tired because of Parkinson's. So it doesn't match with a romantic date or with a new love. It's very difficult for people who don't have, and that you just meet after you were diagnosed. Talking about the loneliness that you feel, and sometimes the apathy, as you said, of not being able or willing to go out of your bed or to go out of your house. It's very hard to explain to people who do not have this, who do not have the disease, what you're going through, both physically and mentally. There are days that you want to stay in bed. You don't want to see any people because you feel ashamed of not being able to walk properly. People who are watching you in the streets because you don't walk normally. Sometimes very painful. Children who are always very honest, just like dogs, I was going to say, who point at you and say, "Mommy, that mister is not walking very nicely. What's going on with him?" That's all very painful to experience if you're outside. Like Parkinson is a struggle always to have to adjust to new realities, and it's normally always getting worse. So you have to psychologically always update yourself to a new reality, which is normally something you can't do anymore, something you can't do anymore. I can't drive a car anymore. I cannot do this sports anymore. It's very difficult now to travel, so maybe I have to travel less. So that's a very confronting process in your head to accept a new reality, which is normally on a downhill, not on an uphill. And that process is very lonely as such, because you can only do that yourself. You have to accept it yourself. Of course, you can talk about it with other people, but it's your process. It's your internal discussion, let's say. And then to be able to go out and to smile, of course, sometimes that's impossible to look happy out to the outside world. And that doesn't help that people are ignoring the issue. I sometimes have discussions with people over the phone, and then they don't even mention Parkinson's because they think I don't want to talk about it. So it's very important that they know that you make clear that you want to talk about it, and it's important to talk about it. Otherwise, it makes the loneliness even stronger, I would say. But I appreciate completely other things than before. As I said, small things, little things, very simple things. A nice cup of coffee, sunshine, walking on the beach, looking at the nature, walking in the parks. Things I would not even think about before when I was having my career and being on the highway. And now it's a different life, but it's not necessarily worse. I would even say that Parkinson has given me a new start. And I think if I was would still be on this highway and this rat race, maybe I would die from a heart attack or a stroke. And let's say thanks to Parkinson's, I'm still there and I'm still enjoying life on a very different pace, on a very much slower pace, but with much more appreciation, I think, for things that really matter. The pandemic had an effect on all people, especially on people with Parkinson's, but how did it affect you, Indu?
Yeah, so the loneliness, I think, has resonated throughout, and the social connection has resonated throughout, I think, all of our worlds. And I have family back in Canada who I still actually haven't seen. My parents have been, you know, locked down there for a good 16 months. So it's been, you know, also reorienting my energy. And I also have to admit that I was traveling a lot and focused a lot on different other things that, you know, sort of this rat race that we were all wrapped up in. So all of a sudden we had time to reflect and think about really what matters and how to kind of keep each other kind of sane and connected. So I started this virtual support group, which has been, you know, honestly therapy for me to see many of my patients weekly and to feel that I'm connecting people. We start with a wave and a smile and then we end with the same. And so it's been something that I think people have looked forward to. I've also done a weekly Zoom meeting with my own parents and my family, and we've celebrated birthdays and graduations and attended little mini concerts of my nephews and my kids, you know, with each other. And so it's a weekly thing that we've looked forward to. And I think in some ways we've taken more time to connect through that technology than we may have had done before when we were, you know, trying to intersect maybe physically in the world in a different way. So I think, you know, this has been important. From a healthcare provider standpoint, you know, it's been a very rough year. A lot of my colleagues have been working tirelessly, frontline workers, and, you know, people have moved in the pandemic to new practice settings, and trainees have come and gone. And it's been very tough because, you know, a lot of our team building at work when we see tough patients is to hug or to, you know, be a shoulder to cry on. And even the physical connection of seeing patients has been absent with, you know, being able to smile or to hold somebody's hand or to hug, which is a huge part of my, you know, the pleasure of my job. So that was really missing. And so the hope was to kind of refine that in other ways. And so I've been relying more on, as you mentioned, getting out in nature, spending more time, you know, reading, reflecting, writing, you know, sort of thinking about the things that are important to me. Spending time in the mind-body practices that have, you know, served me, you know, throughout, but also especially at this time, you know, trying to meditate a little bit more, trying to do more yoga, more breath work, and really trying to proactively reach out to my colleagues, some of whom are also very embarrassed. And there's a huge stigma even in healthcare providers. And so in this pandemic time, I've been giving talks to pretty much anyone who will listen about loneliness and reaching out to others. And in that space, I've had providers reach out to me saying that something I said on the talk resonated and that, you know, they were reaching out because they needed help. And so, you know, I you know, had a specific case I can think about of a doctor that had moved in the pandemic to a new place, had just started working and was really lonely and had actually reached out because she was so lonely that she had actually contemplated suicide that week. So this is a passion that will probably be with me for life because I've realized how transformational it is, not just for my patients, but also for my colleagues and, you know, the people that I love. So we've talked a little bit about realigning purpose. It sounds like you had a very highway, you know, sort of career where everything was fast moving and fast paced. But you mentioned sort of slowing down a little bit and maybe pivoting your purpose to simpler things. I know that you've taken a lot of comfort in the cause of Parkinson's and advocating. Maybe you could teach us a little bit about how you found new meaning and what you've been spending your energy on, and maybe give some tips to maybe our listeners about, you know, how they might do the same.
Having Parkinson's, for me, it should not... Let's put it like this. I don't want to be ill every day, all day. I'm not only a Parkinson patient. I'm also a dog owner, a brother, a son, etc. For me, it's very important to deal with the disease, but I don't want to. I have days that I don't even think about it, and I would like to keep it like that. But the engagement in Parkinson groups is very important. I was always active in the Netherlands and in Belgium in support groups, advocacies. Also, I've been trying to help by lobbying towards the European Union, European Commission, for funding and more awareness about Parkinson. And now I'm living in Spain. My problem is a bit the language and the cultural differences. For example, the support group here for Parkinson patients, where I live, is in Catalan language, in a Catalan language, and I don't speak Catalan. So I was thinking very recently to start a new group for, let's say, non-Spanish-speaking people who live in Spain. I think there is a need for that, and it would also help me as a Parkinson patient, but also to be positively active to try to bridge the gap of awareness raising towards the outside world, because still people are thinking about 80-year-old people with trembling hands. Well, I'm 50. I was 37 when I was diagnosed. I'm not trembling. So to raise awareness about Parkinson, to raise awareness especially on the non-motor implications of Parkinson, because it's very important to educate people who don't have Parkinson's about the holistic implication of Parkinson, and also to tell people that it's not something you should be ashamed about, that it's very good to ask for help and not to stay in your house and feeling lonely, but to go out there. But it takes courage, that takes an effort to accept it first with yourself and then to go out there. And then you will see that if you ask for help or if you speak out, that people are much more willing to listen and to help you than you thought before.
It's been such a pleasure to meet you virtually here and connect, you know, globally across, you know, the ocean and the world here. But I think many of the principles resonate no matter who you are and where you are. You know, the need for having human connection and, you know, taking charge a little bit of the things that you do every day so that you can feel you are driving the bus with Parkinson's and that you can, you know, learn things and apply them and feel better, hopefully. So thank you for this amazing conversation and for what you're doing there. It sounds like an amazing adventure, a beautiful part of the world. And hopefully you can start that support group for folks that are non-Spanish speaking in Spain. And I think, you know, prescribe some social connections to your own folks there.
Thank you very much. It was very, very nice to exchange with you here and very inspiring, especially all the experience and all the ideas that you expressed here. I'm surely going to take your point on social prescription with me here in Spain, if I may, and I will use that in hopefully to make the lives of Parkinson patients a bit better than it is today. And also thanks to you with all your contributions to that. Very nice to talk to you today.
Parkinson's Life magazine is produced by Speak Media on behalf of the European Parkinson's Disease Association, the leading voice for Parkinson's in Europe. This podcast has been supported by a grant from the Boston Scientific Foundation Europe, whose mission is to improve patient well-being using digital or innovative solutions. For the latest research and information on Parkinson's, visit epda.eu.com. Thanks for listening to the Parkinson's Life podcast. If you like what you've heard, please rate and review. It helps make sure that others can find us. Keep a lookout for our next episode this summer, and until then, take care.